Have we started? There we go. Welcome to the Tin Biscuit Podcast. Today we've got a new guest, that is Sean Baker, MD. Well, thanks for coming on, Sean.
Rick, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
No, that's brilliant. The reason why I wanted to get you on, because I first aired you on Joe Rogan. Then Joe Rogan did the 30-day challenge this year, and I thought I'd do 30 days. With the sort of like doing 30 days, I lost, my starting weight was 14 stone 11 pounds, and now it is 13 stone 9 pounds. And that's just from eating animal products. I have included milk, coffee, and dairy into that, but I was just amazed on how it worked. After the 30 days, I did try some other foods, and it just didn't, it just tasted artificial and horrible. But what I want to talk to you about is the medical side of things, because I got a few people saying your poor arteries, it's no good for losing weight because glucose is passed through your liver and all this. And I thought, I'm going to have to get you on to the podcast and explain it, because like people are saying about vitamin C deficiency, vitamin E deficiency, your arteries get clogged, you'll have bad cholesterol, you'll be in a stroke. And I just wanted someone who's an expert, because I'm like, your book explains it all perfectly, but I just wanted to show the people from horse's mouth sort of thing, and obviously ask yourself about it.
I don't know if we want to start at a specific point. I mean, I think one of the things, and if we just kind of, you know, we have to understand that nutrition science in general is very limited in what we can actually make conclusions on. You know, you don't have to take my word on that. There's a guy who sort of invented the term evidence-based medicine, which a lot of us like to throw around as, you know, this is how we should make our decisions. And that term, evidence-based medicine, originated from a guy named Professor Gordon Guyatt, who is at McMaster University in Canada. You know, he's been studying evidence for, his whole career. And he is probably the most qualified guy in the world to talk about this stuff. And he literally basically states that not only is there no significant evidence that shows red meat is bad for you. I mean, most of our nutrition science is like that. We don't have good evidence on anything when it comes to telling us, are we going to have a heart attack? Are we going to die early? Are we going to have a stroke? Are we going to get cancer? We just can't make that conclusion based on any of the evidence we have. The only way we would be able to do those studies are, you know, locking people up in metabolic wards that are twins for 50 years and controlling every variable and then saying what was the outcome. And we're never going to do that. And so there are people that say that, well, yes, we realize we have this really poor, low quality evidence. It's the best we have, and therefore we should utilize that. And I'm like, you know, that's like saying you're going to get on a plane and you look in there and you see that one of the wings is about to fall off, the landing gear is broken, the pilot's drunk, and they're saying that's the best that we can afford. I mean, you're like, no, I wouldn't do that. And so this is where we're coming from when we talk about nutrition-based science when it comes to disease prognostic abilities. And we have people fighting over really weak data and saying, oh, this little bit of weak data shows this and this little weak of data shows that. And so I think we can't do that. And I think what we can do is we can take people that are sick, you know, like maybe in your case, I've got too much body fat, I'm overweight. Maybe someone's diabetic, maybe they have high blood pressure, maybe they have some sort of disease process, whether it's autoimmune disease or gastrointestinal problems or joint pain. And we take those people and we can do something that makes those things go away, where they get better, where they lose weight, their blood pressure goes away. And that's really all we can really do. And anybody that tells you any different is basically just kind of, you know, lying to you, quite honestly. I mean, I could use stronger words, but, they're full of it. But so if we just realize what we can do, then we can focus on doing that with people. And how we get there is, you know, something that you can argue about. But at the end of the day, you are clearly more healthy than you were a month ago. I mean, yeah. you've lost, you know, what is a stone and 2 pounds, right? So you've lost 16 pounds. you know, and I don't know what else went on, but I mean, I would argue that, you know, people that do this are literally healthier. Now, the people will say, well, you could just snort cocaine and do meth and stuff like that. I think that's a silly argument. I think if we get people healthier, regardless of how we get them there, we've done them a favor. They're relatively better than they were before, and that's all we should care about. You know, trying to tell somebody, hey, you're going to get a heart attack in 50 years, I don't really care, because we don't know we just don't know that answer. But the thing you need to do is get healthy and just stay healthy. And how do you stay healthy? You stay not being obese. You stay not having high levels of inflammation. You stay, you know, not having arthritis. You stay having good digestive function. You stay having good mental health and good mood. You stay having, you know, good skin. You know, you stay having, you know, the ability to fight off disease. You stay having, good mental focus, libido, cognition, all those things. The longer you do that, not only is the quality of life you have going to be better, that's clear. I mean, that's obvious, but the longer you can do that, it's very likely that you're going to live longer. I mean, there's no way to prove that, but I mean, I think aging is really just disease that's accumulating. And the less you have disease, the less you've aged. And I think that's how we sort of tackle that. Now, you can individually talk about, well, what about this? What about that? And there's some science out there that supports. Clearly I do not have scurvy. You didn't get scurvy. I've seen exactly zero people that have gotten scurvy on this diet, despite having seen thousands upon thousands of people do it now. Now, you know, like I said, how would you get scurvy? You would eat a low quality diet. You might eat some dried preserved meat, which is what the sailors used to do, you know, years ago. They would eat hardtack, and they would eat dried, basically beef jerky, you know, and then that would give you scurvy. But no one is doing this on a carnivore diet. No one is suggesting to you, you know, if you just have access to fresh meat, and that doesn't mean right off the animal, it's just meat that hasn't been dried or preserved, you're going to be fine. And you're not going to get scurvy. And there's, you know, we can go into all the science behind that, but I don't know if that's, you know, a great use of time right now.
Yeah, what's about when people say about vitamin deficiency, especially vitamin C, and someone mentioned to me vitamin E? What?
Yeah, so vitamin C, scurvy is a clinical manifestation of vitamin C, at least acute, and it usually occurs in about 4 weeks to about 3 months. So if you don't have enough vitamin C relative to what your need is, then you're going to get scurvy, and you're going to get sick, and then eventually you're going to die. So the question is, it's, again, there's two parts to this: how much you ingest versus how much you need. And I think what we're seeing in the absence of carbohydrates, our requirements for vitamin C actually go down significantly. And that's probably the case for a number of different, vitamins and minerals. When we look at the creation of the recommended daily allowances in the U.S. and a lot of countries have followed that, we see that evidence was derived mostly via expert opinion. There was a study, a commission done on by the Institute of Medicine, I think back in 2007, where they reviewed the RDAs for all the food and nutrition requirements. And they basically said, this is based on expert opinion. It's the lowest quality evidence we have. So we really don't know what people actually know, what actually people need. It's based on a population of people eating a standard diet of grain, you know, high amounts of grain and, you know, 50, 60% carbohydrates. And so when we have different populations eating the diets and the requirements seem to be different. Recently, the USDA has acknowledged that with their zinc requirements. They see that people that eat a lot of phytic acid or phytates, which are found in beans and legumes and other plant-based products in high amounts, when you eat a lot of those, more than, say, 1,000 milligrams, they want you to double your zinc intake. And if you eat 2,000 milligrams, they want you to triple your zinc intake. So we are seeing that eating these so-called anti-nutrients, these foods that bind vitamins and minerals, like many plant compounds, it increases our requirements. And when you're not eating those, our requirements actually go down. And so at the end of the day, no one is developing vitamin deficiencies, or at least not clinical signs of it. And the other thing we have to look at is, even serum levels. You can measure vitamin D and vitamin C and vitamin E or whatever you want to measure. We've known this for many, many years, even 100 years ago, that if an animal, like, for instance, had a thiamine, a low serum amount of thiamine, they would get a disease called beriberi, which affects the brain or can affect the heart, depending on the version you get of it. But if those animals have low serum levels of thiamine and they're on a low-carb diet, they don't get the disease. But if they have low serum levels of thiamine and they get on a high-carbohydrate diet, then they do get the disease. So even the serum levels are different. So it may be that we just need less of certain, you know, nutrients when we're on a low carb diet or a meat based diet. So it's very interesting.
What about the, a lot of people have been mentioning to me about the fiber aspects of it, saying like you need fiber for a healthy gut and healthy bowel movements. One thing I didn't notice in my 30 days is I had good bowel movements. The first couple of weeks was a bit touch and miss. If I needed a Trump, it might go a bit south. But when like that faded, I was just going once a day. My like hunger went down. I was maybe eating twice a day, having an 18 to 20 hour intermittent fast. But this thing about fiber, people have got this thing about fiber to have a like sort of healthy digestive system.
Right. Yeah. So that, again, that is based on, I think, Dennis Burkett was a guy, a researcher back in the 1940s that observed African populations, and he saw that they were free of some of the diseases that affect people in the UK, obesity, diabetes and stuff like that. And so what he observed is they ate, you know, more fiber. And so we have this belief that fiber is essential for avoiding disease and being helpful. What a guy like John Yutkin also made the same observation that, guess what, they're not eating a lot of sugar either. And so it was kind of like, who is right? I haven't had fiber in 3+ years. I have regular normal bowel movements pretty much every day. You do not need fiber to have bowel movements at all. I mean, if it were the case, I mean, every carnivorous on the planet would never have a bowel movement. And all the people that, you know, the Inuit and all these people, the Sami, and all these people who live in the polar climates that have very limited access to fiber, you know, would be suffering from that. You know, we did a survey of people doing a carnivore diet for 90 days. 100 of them we surveyed, we checked how frequently they had bowel movements, and they generally had basically a little more than one bowel movement per day. You know, like every 5 days they would have 6 bowel movements. This is what the frequency was on people doing the diet. So to say that you can't have bowel movements is actually incorrect. The fact that people say that you have to have fiber to have a healthy quote unquote gut biome is based on the fact that certain bacteria will interact with fiber and produce something called a short chain fatty acid, which commonly people look at something called butyrate. And butyrate is something that when cells are exposed to that in the gut, it tends to make them arguably healthier. The interesting thing is we can get those short chain fatty acids a whole bunch of other ways. We can get it from ketones. So if you're on a diet where you're producing ketones in a carnivore diet, certainly can allow for that. Those ketones can convert to butyrate. There's a ketone, the most common ketone in the blood is called beta hydroxybutyrate. And as you notice, butyrate and beta hydroxybutyrate sound very similar because there's this one little hydroxyl molecule that's attached to that can come off very easily. So we can easily convert beta hydroxybutyrate to butyrate, and those same cells that benefit from getting it from fiber will also get it from ketones. We also know that the short chain fatty acids can be produced from amino acids, which we get from protein, acetate, propionate, and several others, methyl butyrate. So you don't need it. I mean, this is just another sort of belief being pushed by people that really want to sell you a lot of fiber, cereal industries and some of the other folks that push this up. And fiber is beneficial if you're eating a junk food diet, because what happens is fiber sort of just displaces maybe junk food. Like if you're eating more fruits and vegetables, it's probably better than if you're eating Twinkies and, well, I don't know what you have in the UK as equivalent, you know, these little, you know, desserts and, you know, chocolates and that sort of stuff. Yeah, cakes and all those things. And so so that's probably all the effect is. You know, it's just preventing you from eating other garbage food. But to say it's essential or even healthy, I think is, you know, it's a relative term. You don't need it. It's clearly not required. Or, you know, it's completely indigestible by humans or any mammal or any vertebrate animal on the planet. It's only bacteria that can do anything with it. So it's just one of these beliefs that, you know, we believe fiber is healthy, and therefore a gut microbiome that uses fiber must be a healthy gut microbiome. And we have no decent evidence to make that statement true. We're just speculating when it comes to gut health based on the microbiome, because we're still in the very infancy of studying that system. You know, and I would say that your gut microbiome is healthy when you are healthy, and I think that's probably a fair and a better way to assess that.
Yeah, because I've noticed when I do go to the toilet, not a lot comes out. So is that because the meat's getting absorbed in sort of to the body itself?
Right. Yeah. You're eating food that you actually absorb and you're getting the nutrition. Whereas if you're eating a very fiber rich, plant heavy diet, much of that material is just passing right through you going in the toilet. So actually you're just kind of wasting money, because you've got a lot of the nutrition, the minerals and vitamins and some of the calories actually are bound up. And so it's like you eat all this organic produce, you spend a lot of money on it, you extract a small amount of the nutrition, and the rest goes in the toilet. So you're kind of wasting money, quite honestly. It's a very waste. I mean, we already waste, at least in the United States, 40% of the food we produce is wasted. And, you know, it goes in a landfill, much of it fruit, vegetable, and baked goods. And then you go and then you buy and eat all this food. And a significant percentage of that nutrition also ends up in the toilet. So it's kind of like, you know, when you eat meat, it is well absorbed. You see, all that nutrition goes into your body and very little gets wasted. So now what's going on when you go to the bathroom, you're getting rid of cells, you know, little skins, not skin cells, but epithelial cells from the digestive tract, and you're getting rid of bacteria. And that's the majority of what you're getting in the toilet now. There's very little food residue left over. It's almost nothing when you compare it to, like I said, the fruit vegetable heavy diet or the junk food diet, which has got a lot of this indigestible fiber in it. That all ends up in the toilet. So you have smaller bowel movements, less frequent. You don't have three a day, you might have one a day. But there's literally no evidence to say that having one bowel movement a day or one bowel movement every 2 or 3 days is any better or worse for you than having multiple. In fact, there's a study out there that shows that having multiple bowel movements and lots of fiber is probably worse for your bowel health. It's a nice study that Dr. Ann Peary did back, I think, in 2012, looking at colonoscopies on, I think, 2,000 people. And the ones that ate the most fiber and had the most bowel movements had the greater percentage of diverticular disease, which is this little problem where you get little pouches that pop off your colon and then eventually can become irritated or infected, you know, with diverticulitis.
All right. Okay. That's like really interesting. What about, because I, a couple of years ago, I did read in the papers about red meat causing cancer, and maybe you should limit your red meat intake to once or twice a week. Is there any evidence to support that? Or,
well, I mean that again, that recommendation, you know, this World Health Organization recommendation in 2015 through the IARC, the International Association for Research on Cancer out of Lyon, France, basically that whole committee panel and that statement was based on, again, this really weak epidemiologic evidence, a few rat studies, which also, you know, they eliminated much of the data. There was a guy on there, David, what's David's last name? I'm blanking on his name right now, but he was one of the professors on that panel. And he basically stated that this was the most frustrating experience of his career. They completely disregarded all evidence that would say red meat does not cause cancer. About a third of the panelists on that panel were vegan, vegetarians, and Seventh-day Adventists. They failed to disclose it as a conflict of interest. Since that study has come out in 2019, Gordon Guide, who I mentioned, the father of evidence-based medicine, and 14 other colleagues did the largest review ever on red meat that's ever been done. And their conclusion, when they used strong criteria, when they said, look, we're going to hold this data up to very high scientific rigor, came to the very different conclusion, saying that there's no evidence that red meat causes, you know, or at least no strong evidence whatsoever. It's only weak evidence that shows that red meat is, you know, causes cancer, heart disease, or any other disease. And their recommendation was just keep eating what you're eating. Don't worry about it. There's no reason to change. And I think that's consistent with saying we're going to look at strong evidence versus just really weak, you know, the plane without the wing and the drunk pilot evidence. You know, this is a difference here. So this is the thing that people that are plant-based advocates hold up this World Health Organization, but this new one, when it comes out and it's done with more rigor, greater scope, with less, you know, without the conflict of interest that these guys that are vegans, vegetarians, now we have guys like Neil Bernard, the founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, suing the journal to have them retract this. They don't want the science out there. They want to censor people. And this is what we have: censorship versus science, which is religious ideology and dogma versus let's actually do science. And so I would say that, you know, there's no strong evidence that would suggest red meat causes cancer.
Because it seems to me, and also you brushed about it in like your book, that meat eaters get put into the same category as carnivore people, but a lot of meat eaters eat a lot more crap with like potatoes, other high fat foods besides meat. So do you think that's got something to do with them, like the study and how it affects it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a so-called healthy user bias. This is one of the problems with epidemiology. And so if I tell somebody, hey, meat eating is bad for you and smoking's bad for you and drinking alcohol is bad for you and not wearing your seatbelt is bad for you and not exercising is bad for you, you know, and so on and so forth, and you say, oh, I don't give a crap. I'm going to eat meat. I'm going to smoke. I'm going to drink. I'm not going to exercise. Those people are very different, and that's the vast majority of people that, you know, that have, you know, decided to eat meat because we've been told it's bad for us for so long. But there's that's a very different from a population for like someone who, myself, who exercises regularly, you know, maintains a healthy body weight, you know, eats meat regularly, but doesn't eat the sugar and the junk and the, you know, the processed foods and refined seed oils and stuff like that. Those are very two different populations. And until you sort those out, you can't say that meat is causing the problem, because in truth, in the United States, the American diet, only 5% of the American diet is red meat. Something like, you know, beef is only like 2 ounces a day. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny amount that we eat. And then to try to blame health woes and something that's, you know, 5% of the diet is, in my view, ridiculous. When we eat five times as much, you know, refined grains, sugar, you know, seed oils and that sort of stuff. And so we should really be pointing the finger there. And what we're seeing with this carnivore population, and you saw it yourself, we get healthier. We lose the diseases. We get off pills. You know, and the people that would make the argument that a whole food plant-based diet is better, they're seeing some of the same things. And we're saying, well, what's the common denominator here? What is everybody giving up? We're giving up all the crap, garbage, processed stuff. And that's where we should really be focusing our energy, in saying, don't eat that stuff. You know, you can eat meat, you can eat vegetables, you can eat both if you want. But to say that meat is the bad guy clearly doesn't make sense. Now, I would say you could take people that only eat junk food, that only eat meat, and only eat whole food plant-based diets. And I will tell you, the one that's going to be the least healthiest is the people that only eat junk food. And I think the people that are going to be the most healthiest, in my experience, are the ones that only eat meat. And then probably the second healthiest are going to be the people that eat the plants without the junk food. So, I mean, it's clearly the junk food and not the meat.
And sort of what effects does it have on your heart and arteries, eating fried food, cooked in lard or ghee or things like that, and having milk and butters? And what sort of impact does it have on them, like someone's heart? Because like someone messaged me the other day saying, your poor arteries and your poor heart, you've got to have this, you've got to have that.
I mean, it's a good question. And I think, you know, like for mine, I mean, I had my coronary artery calcium scan, which is an assessment, one of the better assessments you can do on heart health. And mine was perfect, completely zero score. I mean, I've got, you know, I'm able to set world records and compete at a world-class level on, you know, fitness-related sports. So my heart function is quite good. I've seen thousands of other people's in a very similar situation, only eating meat. But I think when we look at heart disease, it's very easy to be focused on one thing. Everybody's focused on just cholesterol. Well, we know that cholesterol, if it's elevated in many people, is a problem. And the problem is it's the same thing. These are the people that have diabetes, that have inflammation, that have all these metabolic problems in addition to cholesterol, where cholesterol is a problem. But what happens when you take the diabetes away, the inflammation away, the visceral fat away, and then in those people that have elevated cholesterol, and they have good, and if they have really good triglycerides and triglyceride HDL ratios, when we look at those people, it seems, and there's some data, maybe the Framingham data, which is a big study done, you know, thousands of people, it seems that when all those other things are good, then cholesterol doesn't seem to have the impact. And so it's really, you know, who you're talking about and what category. You know, the problem is most people are in this obese, you know, inflamed, diabetic, pre-diabetic, hyperinsulinemic category. And when we put cholesterol in that group, they have problems. But if we can get those people out of that category where they're no longer diabetic, where they're no longer inflamed, where they're no longer obese, when they no longer have visceral fat problems, you know, when they no longer have high inflammatory markers, then it's arguable that cholesterol doesn't have the view. And it's more important to look at not just the risk factor, which cholesterol is one of many, smoking, age, sex, family history, some of these other factors we talked about. It's better to look at disease itself. And so when you actually scan the arteries, when you actually scan the heart, we're seeing that people that are doing this carnivore diet tend to do very well. And that's, I think that's different. So it's different. Risk factors are different from disease. Risk factors means, hey, you might get something, but disease is really what you want to measure, because then you can see, yes, I did or I did not.
Right. What's in your opinion is the reason why just having this carnivore diet is curing autoimmune diseases like Michaela Peterson, Jordan Peterson, people with thyroid coming off the tablets. I had Brett on the podcast on Saturday, and he's given up his tablets. I mean, his transformation is amazing from like being where he was to having no meds for his depression and anxiety, and he's smashing in the gym. What's some like the reasoning behind just eating meat curing all this? Is your opinion?
I might have to eat my dogs here. I'm just kidding. there's a number of things. I think one of the leading thoughts is that gut permeability. So there's this so-called leaky gut syndrome where we see certain foods cause the guts to allow more foreign products, more foreign particles, bacterial particles to pass through our membranes. And that kind of becomes bound to some of our proteins in our body, our own proteins as foreign, and then we have our immune system attack ourselves. And I think what we're seeing is that leaky gut syndrome sort of gets better. It goes away. And there's some data out of a group in Hungary that does research on this and showing pretty dramatically that going on a carnivore diet or what they call a paleolithic ketogenic diet, which is basically almost the same thing, fixes that leaky gut problem. And so when the leaky gut problem goes away, the gut permeability, you know, is normalized. The inflammatory markers, some of the immune markers that are associated with autoimmune disease go away, and then the autoimmune symptoms fall shortly afterwards. And so I think that's probably the major reason for that to occur.
Excellent. Right. I know you're really busy, so I've got one more thing because it's been quite hard getting this set up. What's your background medical-wise, and how did you become on the sort of carnivore diet, and what's your regular diet sort of dietary intake for like sort of food wise? So that's really three things.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my medical background, I was in, you know, just a standard, you know, orthopedic surgeon. You know, I went to medical school, graduated near the top of my class in honors. I did my training in orthopedics, you know, went to the military, was sent to Afghanistan, did a bunch of combat trauma, then went into private practice, you know, for quite a few years. Just, you know, seeing the normal day-to-day, you know, knee replacements, hip replacements, shoulder replacements, sports injuries, fractures, taking care of all that stuff, operated on thousands of patients. And then as I got into my 40s, I saw that my health was starting to decline. Even though I'd been an athlete and still competing at a high level, I was, you know, heavier than I probably needed to be. I was developing metabolic syndrome, wasn't sleeping well, I had sleep apnea, you know, started to have a little bit of blood pressure issues, and I started decided that, you know, I can't train any harder because I was already training very hard, and started looking into fixing diet. And then I went through just a whole series of different diets. I started out with a low fat, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of fiber, lean, you know, real lean, you know, chicken and fish. And yeah, I mean, to be honest, that worked. I mean, I worked very well for me. I lost 50 pounds within 3 months' time. I went from, you know, I guess I'll calculate it in stone for you. It was about 24, no, it was about 20 stone, you know, five or six, down to, what is it, 230 pounds. So I lost about 4 stone or something like that. 40, yeah, something like that. Yeah, that right about that. Almost 4 stone in 3 months. Got lean, But I was literally miserable. I mean, I was hungry all the time. I was grouchy. My mood was bad. My energy was low. The nurses at the hospital didn't like me. They said, oh, we like the fat Dr. Baker better because you're in a better mood. And, I realized I couldn't do this, just lean, low fat stuff forever. And it was just not sustainable for me. And so I switched over to a Paleolithic diet for a while. Did that for, a year or two. And then I got into low carb, reading, a number of the books that are out there, and just kind of got fascinated with it and started doing that. And then I went on a ketogenic diet and started using it in my patients with good success. And then I finally, just for some reason, started looking at these people doing a carnivore diet and, thought about it as far as a performance enhancement for athleticism, and it made sense to me. And I tried it. I tried it for 30 days, and I felt great. It was a good experience. I went back to the diet I was on, the more ketogenic diet, and I just didn't feel as good. Started seeing some joint pain coming back. Mood wasn't as good. Energy wasn't as good. Digestion wasn't as good. So, I think within a day or two, I went back on the all meat diet, and I've been there since, more than a little over 3 years now. And I mean, my diet right now is about 90%, 95% red meat. It's usually some sort of steak or burger. I'll include eggs in there from time to time. I'll include fish in there from time to time. I'll include a little bit of dairy from time to time. I tried to incorporate some fruit back in recently, and just didn't feel as good. I thought I could try it, but it was just like, I just don't feel as good. So it's one of those deals where, I just do this. I usually eat about twice a day, and that's my routine. Sometimes I'll eat once a day. Sometimes it'll be three times a day, but it's generally dictated by activity and appetite and what my goals are at the time. When I'm trying to gain weight, I'll eat a little more frequently and try to force myself. I have a really hard time, putting on any kind of weight. It's hard to put on fat. It's just challenging just eating meat. I mean, you can do it, but but I find I have to eat well past satiety and have to sit there and be miserable. To do that. Now, like the same thing, if I want to put on muscle, I've got to do the same thing. I've got to eat a lot. Now, if I want to get leaner, it's very easy to do. I just kind of eat a little less frequently and eat a little bit more lean and maybe slightly less food, and I get lean very quickly. So it's that's what I found, and I feel great. I mean, my joints don't hurt. I wake up full of energy. Do great in my training. Everything is just goes well.
I have found in the 30 days I did it, I am my focus was better. And when I came home from work, I am was actually tired. I'd like didn't want to stay up late. I didn't want to go on the computer, didn't want to watch any films or Netflix. I just wanted to go to bed. And that's one thing I did find. And as I say, my mood improved. I lost all that weight. My blood pressure's right. It's good. Do you just drink water, or do you incorporate anything like milk or coffee or tea or anything like that with it?
I've never liked coffee or tea, so I don't drink it. I mean, I generally just drink water. Sometimes it's sparkling water. I mean, once in a while I'll have a glass of tea with my girlfriend. I'll have a glass of wine occasionally. I mean, I don't drink very much alcohol. I don't find it's not a health food. And so my girlfriend's from France, and so she'll want to have a glass of red wine once in a while, so I'll sit down and have that. In fact, I had my neighbors over for dinner. I cooked them steaks, and we had a glass of wine. But generally, I mean, I look at it what does every animal on the planet drink? I mean, they're not drinking flavored water or this sort of water. I mean, that's what we're designed to drink. And so I mostly, probably 99% of what I drink is just plain old water, which is fine. And I find it works quite well. It quenches your thirst very
It does,
nicely.
yeah.
Yeah,
And sorry, go on.
I was going to say, once you lose that sort of addiction or craving for sugar, you don't need that to drink it. A lot of people just drink it all the time because they're constantly craving sweet and sugar. And so that's why we have this entire industry that likes to sell us that stuff at, for good profit and not for our health.
Because I did have a donut. I did a little experiment with certain foods like biscuits and donuts and KFC, and it just tasted artificial. I mean, the donut tasted like a donut, but it just didn't taste very nice. It tasted stodgy, didn't taste fresh, didn't taste natural. It just tasted manufactured crap. Just not nice at all.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a lot of people find that, you know, they'll do this for a while, then they'll be excited to have their cheat meal, and they'll eat it, and they're like, eh, it wasn't that good, you
Yeah.
know, and I feel like garbage. And so you find that the more you go, you know, the more you find that, hey, I just want to eat a nice steak. And that's kind of, it's hard to put your mind around that until you do it for a while. And you know, when you get a month or two, 3 months in, you're like, just give me a damn steak. That's what I want, you know. And it's funny how that works.
That's it, because one thing I did notice as soon as I did start eating, which I've cut back, I've just gone back to carnivore now, but one thing I did notice is my reflux acid started to come back. I started to burp a lot more, and I've started to get a bit more bloated, as I'm like sort of well. So I'm like 100% going off this processed crap food and just sticking to fresh natural meat and just like animal products. Because that's where I think it is. You went to one of them Brazilian restaurants on like one of your stories, and how much meat did them like? Was it 6 pounds of meat in like one sitting?
Yeah, I mean, I did that once, you know, once. I mean, I've done that a few where I've had these big feasts, but I go to those, not, you know, when I go out to eat, those are good places to go, because it's for the money you can, you know, what you'd spend, and to get the same amount of meat in a regular restaurant would cost you hundreds of dollars, where you can get a lot cheaper in a kind of a Brazilian place. So, yeah, I mean, I don't do that often, but
Six
yeah,
pounds of
sometimes
meat.
I mean, the most I ever ate in one sitting was 8 pounds, which was,
Eight.
I was pretty miserable with that. It was kind of a thing. I was going to do a 48-hour fast, and so it was kind of a, let's fill ourselves up for 2 days, and that's usually what I would eat in 2 days. So I ate it all in one meal, and I don't like that. It's not, you know, it's not my preferred way. I prefer to eat every day, so usually it's twice a day, but that's pretty rare I do that.
Like, how did you feel after 8 pounds worth of meat?
I mean, I felt like a snake that just swallowed a goat. I mean, I just kind of laid on the couch for like 3 hours. It was like 3 hours of not comfort, and then it was fine. But I mean, I don't do that very often. It was kind of just a one-off thing.
Great. Well, if people wanted to find out a bit like more about you, like where sort of do they go and where can they go?
Yeah, well, I like to, you know, send people to a new website we launched. It's called meetrx.com. So meet, and then the RX, like prescription. We have daily meetings. I'm there every single day talking to people. I have, you know, dozens and dozens of people come in, and we just chat. So that's one place to directly interact. It's a great resource for recipes, for scientific articles about the environment. We have, you know, access to coaching, which is super affordable. It's like $18 US for a 30-minute coaching session. It's bizarrely, you know, affordable. I mean, we're intentionally doing that. I do spend some time on social media. I've got a YouTube channel, just my name, Sean, Shawn Baker. My Instagram, I'm pretty active on. It's Shawn, Shawn Baker, Baker, and then 1967, 1967. So that's the year I was born. And then I'm on Twitter still. I haven't been banned. You know, S Baker MD. I think the S and the B are capitalized, and then the M and the D are capitalized, because Twitter's sensitive about the capitalization. So those are the major places where I'm at. But like I said, I'm trying to put most of my efforts into getting people to MeetRx. You know, I'm concerned about, you know, quite honestly, there's more and more sort of censorship going on across these social media platforms, where they're trying to limit the wrong think type of stuff. And they want us all to think and talk a certain way. And the plant-based message is being, you know, pushed out in the efforts to get people softened up, so they will buy all the fake meat products and, you know, contribute to this projected $140 billion industry that they're trying to grow. And so they're trying to manipulate people through media, social media, advertising, you know, research to show people that they should be eating their fake meat, you know, plant products. And I obviously disagree with that.
There's a big push on it to the minute with vegans and vegetarians and this artificial meat stuff. It's coming up more and more, especially in the UK. We've got little white independent coffee shops and that selling vegan chocolate cake, vegan this. Okay, that it's like whatever floats your boat. But what I'll do is I'll put all your details in the description of the podcast, because like the video will go on YouTube and then you'll be able to find it on all podcast platforms.
Sounds good. Awesome. I look forward to hearing it, man. Appreciate the opportunity. I've got to jump on and go do a consult with somebody now.
So. That's it. Well, I just want to thank you so much for like doing the time and just giving me that 40 minutes.
Awesome. Well, anyway, Rick, I appreciate it. Have a good day. Good luck with the diet. And like I said, let us know how we can help you, man.
I'll like sort of see you on your website as well.
Take care. Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. The Tea Biscuits Podcast.